Welcome to part three of my discussion with Michelle Golder and Amanda Steckley. When you turned up for that first day and you saw this village partly built, what was your first thought? I mean, I guess it's down to distressing, first of all. I mean, these are almost like brand new buildings. They're not going to fit right.
Did look quite new. Yeah, that was pretty much my first impression. And actually, I mean, it all comes from the intention of the text. It all comes from what's the story, what's happening, you know, and what does it need? What's gone on here? You know, this isn't a new environment. This is a lived in, has some sense of grunge. So it's all looking very sparkly and new. And some of the background colours, I mean, Chris, one of the first things Chris said to me, well, I said, oh, it looks quite fresh. And he said, well, yeah, obviously this is background colours. So I said, well, I'm going to take it down a few tones then. Is that what you want? And so, you know, that it was a case of asking questions because I knew that Chris had been one of the writers. I mean, it's, you know, his story. So finding out from him where he wanted it to go was quite important. I couldn't work with him and tell him what I thought. It was finding out really from him as much as I could. My opinion was, you know, probably best kept to myself on the first day, really, rather than sort of coming in with brushes and starting to do something to it. But yeah, I mean, distressing it was something that I know that's what you wanted me to come in and start doing. Mm. So that was my initial thing.
And so that's about it looking lived in, I guess, old.
Mm.
Yes. Knocking the corners off things. I mean, poor Chris did get a little bit fractious when I actually literally started knocking some of the wooden slatting. I actually started taking a hammer to it because I think, I don't know if you built it or Chris had built it, and I was literally knocking it.
I was amazed at the transformation. I really was. I remember the first day you came with a paintbrush and started doing your stuff, and you were sort of teaching these guys, possibly, as certainly Chris, as you went. And I mean, I must say, I was completely I fully admit I was completely ignorant of this. I thought, surely we just throw a couple of buckets of mud at it or something. You know, I just really had no idea how you made a village look lived in, you know, with paint. And when I could see it, it was like a picture developing.
Right.
Because it was a process of adding layer after layer after layer. And so the picture developed.
Mm-hmm.
And wow,
mm-hmm.
That looks great. You know,
yeah.
that looks real.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you felt, Michael, but I was like, that, you know, it sort of really brought it to life for me.
Yeah, I think it's why you have people who know what they're doing, if you can get them, because although I knew you didn't throw a bucket of mud at it, I would have thrown a bucket of paint at it. Whereas Amanda turned up with the brushes and said, oh, I need some green. It's like, what do you want green for? You don't want greenhouses. And of course, it's not that. It's about the components of what you're really looking at if you break it down. And so you build that up, and amazing result is that it actually looks like it was lived in. And it's been there for years, but some of the other work you did, it wasn't
the green
quite...
just to establish is the lichen that's grown on top of in shade. Yeah, don't paint the building green just to get it clear, right?
There was a component, yes,
yeah, exactly, it's a layer.
So I mean, there was that work that was going on. There was the hacking of pieces of wood that we'd spent weeks building.
It was just too neat and tidy. It was just in nice straight lines.
Well, I think that showed up best on the beams. I mean, once the beams went up, we took some down and hacked them about with an axe.
Yeah.
And then they look a lot different once they go back up. But there was also, you mentioned it already, Khan's house, the indoor house.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was that very quick turnaround towards the end where we, you know, you built an internal set almost over one weekend. Or perhaps
two
a week,
internal sets.
Or 2 weekends.
Actually,
I'm not sure. And then it got converted.
Three internal sets.
Oh, there was the there was the prison.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I wasn't there for.
It was actually four. It was the dungeon, and then there's Khan's house and Dagron's house.
Yeah.
Ren's bedroom, and then that turned into the prison.
The guard room.
Yeah. So,
but only three were built in over that one.
Well, yeah,
Khan's house.
We'll just let you off.
But that whole internal, that whole Dagron's house piece came about in the space of about 2 weeks flat, I think. And then the guard room came out overnight. So you finished filming, I think, by the next day you needed it to be a guard room.
Yes, that's right.
What sorts of things were you getting involved in there, and what were the particular challenges?
Oh, gosh, which bit of your question should I answer? I mean,
all right, let's make it maybe simpler. What was the toughest piece around that that you had to deal with?
Possibly things like, I mean, the weather was quite challenging. Sort of getting everything inside, getting all the flats inside, reconfiguring the flats, because we built the interior sets out of the pieces of the external scenery. So reconfiguring all of that and then rebuilding it into interior set. We didn't have the pieces of the flats to be able to build the interiors and leave the lovely medieval village exterior set standing outside looking lovely with its bits of thatch. So it was a total reconfigure. So that was quite a challenge, stripping it, figuring, I mean, it was a quick kind of conversation between, you know, Chris and I, which flats we used, how much actual space we'd need for camera space, how big they really needed to be. That was a quick sort of walk around with a piece of paper and a pencil just to say, no, we really do need it to be this big. Sorry, Chris. We really do need that many flats.
And so it got bigger and bigger, didn't it?
It did get a little bit bigger, and Chris really wanted it to be a bit smaller, and I think, and it needs to be this big, because we need to elbow space for everybody to be in, to be able to film it, because sometimes, obviously, the less space we needed to build, the less space we needed to decorate and so on and so forth, but we needed that amount of space. So pulling all those flats in, disassembling everything, taking bits of thatched, lovely thatched roof off, which you yourself had helped construct outside in a very sort of weatherproof way, because we'd had such awful storms and so on, and tried to make them strong enough to resist the weather and be external set, and then disassemble all that, bring it in, reconfigure it into those interiors. That was probably the hardest in a relatively short space of time.
And with very few helpers.
With very few people.
And then at one point, I think you were the only one there.
Yeah.
It was one day.
It was one day, then I was the only one there. And somebody came, and I was having a bit of a tough time at the time. And somebody came and offered me pizza, and I was so tired. And while everyone was having lunch, and I was so tired, I couldn't even eat. I was just painting. And that was quite tough, probably, because we were at such a short, no, we've got to get this finished because we're filming tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so I was painting.
We cried in each other's arms on more than one occasion when no one else was around.
Yes, we did, exactly. It was just, we've got to get this bloody thing finished. Sorry, I'm not supposed to. Yeah, it was just that. That was probably, we've got to get this finished. This has got to be finished. And I was sort of, you know. And having an expectation of how I wanted it to be. And trying to get that done so that it could look as good as it could be. And I think the end result's
which I really loved. I loved the fact that you never compromised. I loved that. I really respect that so much. I think that was true of everyone. But, you know, because sometimes we would be there and I would know that it would be... It's so easy to compromise in these situations. This is too hard, I can't do it. But if you really want to make a great... thing, you've got to say no, no matter what. I'll die in the traces. You know, sorry.
I will stick material on this wall if it kills me.
Yeah.
But I think actually, when I look back at those rooms and they are the main character's living space. It can't get much more important than that. You know, it's Ren's bedroom, and I wanted it to look right. You know,
and it does look beautiful.
And I think it looks nice. Yeah. Oh, so I'm pleased that we didn't compromise on that sort of suite of space. And Dagron's room, that lovely table, I think looks really nice. So I'm pleased that we didn't. I'm pleased that I, you know, cried, and we worked hard, and we had some great. Again, it's not. I mean, it's not me. You know, we had some great assistants helping out. Sophie and Claire, who were phenomenal, and the dungeon I thought looked fantastic. They worked so hard and filmed until midnight. You know, finished. Packing up, God knows why. So that, sorry, didn't answer your question.
It wasn't just about painting. You were also, you know, a bucket of trinkets in your arms, and you're going, right, this would go on this shelf, and this would make sense over here. I mean, what sort of things going through your mind there?
very much what the character, it's all character driven and story driven. Again, it all comes from the text and the talking to Kate and talking to Chris and Michelle as well, and you know, finding out what it is, especially Khan's house. I mean, Khan's house was that was a bit difficult because it was kind of Chris and Kate and Michelle, and I would often talk to them at different times, and they might have slightly different sort of twists on the essential characters of the room, but trying to encapsulate that and really make it honest and true, and get the detail within the living spaces of the characters right, from the characters, from the text, and not get too metaphorical about it, but find out where, you know, in Khan's house, why he would have something near him, why there's a seating area in Khan's house. He would have a sheepskin sitting area because he would look at his maps. And he would consult his books and his maps, and he might have a large candle there because he'd read by that candle. So he'd need a large candle with a large wick near the maps. So the logic to the living space and the logic to the type of person that he is comes from the text and comes from the people who've written the text for me. So it's a case of inhabiting the character and then creating the environment.
So it's very much in there about the functionality of all those items. Why would they be there? What would they be there for? It's not just some random placement.
Oh, crikey, no. Never, ever. Every decision you make is a design decision, and it's led by, you know, it's a choice. It's an absolute choice. There's no putting down of a thing, ever.
And luckily we had some beautiful things to use.
To choose from.
Because we had Kat Stone's contributions. She did some of the maps and drawings and things. Mm-hmm. The books,
really nice,
the leather-covered books. And Hans Goosen, who made the mirror.
Yes.
And the, am I allowed to say, the wreather. A key prop.
I said it now.
And, you know, these were beautiful objects, I think.
Yeah.
And so that was... It was lovely to have the opportunity.
Absolutely.
To use those objects.
Yeah.
Even if they weren't in shot, and I don't know. I haven't seen
that.
Well,
no, that's part... I mean, it's the edit, but, you know. It's, yeah. Part of my job as a dresser is to edit out as well and to see what's relevant and what's not relevant, you know, and to distill it down sometimes.
Would Khan own this? Would
Why would he have that there, or would he not? You know, because, you know, Khan's house is quite eclectic, but... say Dagron and Ren's house, they would not have nice cutlery or implements. They would not have wealthy vegetable selection on their table. It would be stripped down. It would be more sparing. So to edit out things is very key as well.
It's very much a two-way street too. I mean, the designer comes to it through the script, but when you have the discussion with the designer about particular objects and why this character is using this object, or where is this object going to be in relation to the character, that deepens your understanding of the script and the action in the script, and you may even result in a change.
Yes.
Because you realize that actually that action or that placement or that use of that object wasn't true. In fact, I'm not sure, I must ask Kate, but the mirror went through several iterations. I remember having discussions about it. Now it's all lost in the mists of time. But what the mirror would look like, I think originally it was seen as written as just a mirror that was on the wall. And then we discussed what mirrors meant. I don't know if you were there for that discussion,
yes,
but we had a long discussion about what mirrors meant and what looking in mirrors meant and what does that say about a character, that they have a mirror on their wall and so forth. And that resulted in this wonderful mirror, which Hans Goosen ended up making for us and sending from Amsterdam. So I love that whole side of the process. That's one of my, it's just my favorite thing is how these people and
make a question and,
emerge from conversations and discussing, and if she had a mirror, what would it look like, and if she had a mirror that looked like that, where would she keep it, and how often would she look into it, and what's she looking for when she looks into it. It's all, that's the beauty of film, that film enables you to, this sounds incredibly pretentious, but it does, it enables you to show what someone's thinking without them saying anything. Yes. Theatre is very dialogue based. You can't make sure that the audience is looking at a face at a particular time or an object at a particular time.
It's more complex to try and do that in theatre. It's certainly more difficult. And film you can be much more allegorical and much more euphemistic, I think, can't you? You can use metaphor in a much more abstract way. I mean, you can certainly do that in theatre, but you do it in different ways. You can do it in design ways, and that's what you can't do in film as much. You can't design a set that is extremely metaphorical.
Well, they tried to do that in The Bodyguard, which our friend was in. And did you see it?
No.
I think it's possibly still running.
Right.
I saw it a couple of times because my friend was in it, and they had kind of tried to apply some filmic principles to the set design. So it had a set design in which they could close off sections of the set, mimicking like the aperture of a camera, and therefore force you to look at a particular bit of action or something. Uh-huh. But some people liked it. I found it very contrived, and it was not something that I found exciting for production. I found other design solutions to the problem of directing attention much more interesting in theatre. But it's a challenge.
And I don't know how I could have forgotten it, but of course there's the market itself. Yes. The difference about the market from the other sets, I think, is the other sets, however long they've been built for, were actually in use for a week or 2 weeks or a day, 2 days, whatever it was. But the market was there for, you were shooting in the market for 4 or 5 weeks.
Much longer than we thought we were going to be.
3 weeks.
3 weeks. I think it might have been longer, to the point where the vegetables were dying off.
Yep.
But there's an awful lot of bits and pieces going on there. And one set of props in particular, I think, were the toys that were in the middle.
Yes.
I'm not sure who made those.
It's a gentleman who donated them to us. It's a friend of a friend, I believe, of Kate's, who contacted us quite early on and said, I make wooden toys. Would these be of any use to you? And we, at that point, didn't really even know what they were going to look like. And then they arrived. And I'll tell you something I haven't told anyone else before. At that stage, or around that stage, we hadn't decided what Dagron sold in the marketplace. And this was a key character thing. And we had talked about it a lot, but we found the character of Dagron really, really difficult. We talked around his character a lot and hadn't made any decisions. And one of the things we talked about was, was he a woodcutter? And if had he been a woodcutter, and then he's injured, I won't say more than that, but at some point in the history of Rand, he's injured and he can no longer practice his previous trade. So what was he doing now? And when we saw these toys, they, to me, immediately said Dagron. Mm-hmm. They encapsulated his character because they were rough hewn, but they were war weapons. They were like a trebuchet.
Yes,
and
yeah.
So they had his sort of manly
masculinity
to them. So you could imagine that a former woodcutter might have turned his hand, given that he can't go out into the forest anymore, to making things out of wood.
Yes.
And he had a variety of things, pipes and things that he was selling. But these toys really stood out. They were the sort of thing that the camera, I think, will pick up. I haven't actually seen the cut of that yet again. And that was one of those serendipitous moments.
Right. They really suit him.
Yeah. And when I saw the way, I don't know whether this was your idea in the first place or how it came about, but him sitting at his stall with the toys on the barrels. That was you, Michael. Yes. Well done. Covered with a leather skin. I thought, yes, that works.
I arranged them.
So I was really, really pleased about that.
They looked nice, didn't they?
Yeah. I must find his name, though. I'm sorry. I have a memory like Swiss cheese.
They do, but it's very nice, but it's one of a whole market of stalls that you had to set up. And you mentioned continuity as well. And of course, that comes into play, I guess, when you're doing 5 weeks of shooting. How did you handle that?
It is just a careful job. You have to have an eye for detail. A lack of continuity in film is something that people do really pick up on.
It jumps out, doesn't it?
It really stands out. Even down to, there was a bread stall, as you know, and that being inaccurate, just the shaping of things, because it's a blur in the background, but the general shaping of loaves on something like that really stands out because it's a pattern. And if you get that wrong, and it's a cut away and a cut back, it's a different shape. And if you've got, it's just beige and it's in the background, but if it's a different shape, it's just going to look different. People are going to, it's just a sort of, it's like a tick, you know, people are going to notice. I would, that's my job, to notice things like that. But I think there are going to be a section of your viewing audience, whether that's even 15%, 20%, that's enough for me to say, no, I'm sorry, that's just not good enough. You know? For people to be put off watching, even, you know, slightly, is bad, frankly, and is worth 10 minutes of our time to go around really readjusting things with an iPad just to make sure. The ideal would be that, you know, we had three production assistants with an iPad each just going around checking everything.
Technology is the best solution to this problem, isn't it? But we had so many technology issues on this shoot.
Well, what we tried with was, you know, uploading the pictures, and then everybody had all the continuity pictures. That would be the ideal, but, you know, we struggled to do that.
We just really, as Neil once said, Ren breaks everything. Anything technological that came into contact with Ren instantly stopped working.
So what we ended up doing was, you know, generally my Apple Mac with people kind of pumping,
which did break at one point.
Oh my god, the battery just died because everybody was flicking through all the pictures so much that the battery kept going and it just wouldn't cope. So we ended up,
and there was a day that I thought I'd uploaded pictures
and we lost them, and
when they weren't there, and we still don't, to this day I do not know what happened to those pictures.
Anyway, we struggled on, and most people were extremely, extremely helpful. You know, all the production assistants, all the runners, everybody who worked on it, tried their best, and that's the only thing. You know, if people try their best, what more can you ask, really? To try and keep the continuity going. The most difficult thing was the vegetable store. Because, you know, you can't keep celery alive after 3 weeks. It just doesn't want to play.
And you've tried.
I tried, you know. I talked to it nicely. I stroked it in the morning. I plunged it into freezing cold water, and it just wouldn't play. But I don't think you're going to notice it too much.
So we've covered an awful lot of bits and pieces there. I mean, if you think back to all the time that you've been working on Ren, have either of you got particular favourite things that happened, or things you worked on, or days, or people, or, you know, something that really stands out as, oh, that was a great day, I remember that?
There are so many for me, but I think that it was the very last night of shooting. We did a sequence where the horse runs away down the bridle path, and I got to be on set, which I didn't get to very often, so that was always a good day for me. And we had, it was the horse that we had got was another very fortuitous find. She'd been riding past, and my dog had chosen to bark at her horse, and I'd gotten chatting with her, and she'd volunteered her horse. So, you know, it was very much something that we didn't know whether it was going to happen. It was a dream that we have that shot, and we managed to get it. We managed to get every shot that Kate had dreamed of, which I think is amazing. Mm-hmm. So it was night. It was a beautiful, cold autumn night, and we brought these enormous gates that you guys had made from these half rounds around to the bridle path, and some genius, and I don't know who it was, had affixed torch sconces to the sides of these things, and they were lit. And it was a velvety dark night, and we had the stunt rider in Ren's costume, which was beautiful. And the shot was just her riding down this bridle path, and then flaming arrows were shot after her, not at the same time. Though it would look like it. But it was just so much fun. It was a really tiny team. It was just a really core team of people who'd been there a lot. There was that sense of a coming to an end, which is always emotional. There was that exhaustion, which adds to that feeling of There must be a word for it.
Euphoric, slightly.
Yeah, kind of a euphoric.
When you're really tired, I think there is something slightly euphoric when you're really late at night.
And you know that the next day is going to be a really quiet one and you don't have to do anything stressful and this is the last thing that's happening. But it just also happened to be very, very beautiful. A beautiful horse. Everything worked. It looked fabulous. It just felt magical. It just had that magical feeling for me.
Lovely. I spent a lot of time in Khan's house. And Khan's house, funnily enough, Khan's house went... We didn't film in Khan's house until fairly late on in the shoot. And it had a lovely smell, Khan's house, actually. When it was undressed, it was fairly kind of naked inside quite a lot. So we dressed it fairly late. And things had been collecting and building up over the time, but the sheepskins had been in there on this kind of little seating area, and occasionally I'd go in there and find someone sitting in there just to get a little bit of peace and quiet, or a bit of quiet time, because it was very calm actually in there. It had this lovely sense of calm, and it smelt of almost green tea or something. It had this beautiful smell. It was a very, very calm environment. And then gradually the things were building up to go in it. And it was a really slow build-up of all this stuff. And then we started dressing it. And I dressed it really slowly, actually, over several days. I don't know if you remember. It took
a luxury.
I do remember, yeah.
It was a real luxury to dress it like that. Normally, you know, you kind of dress it in an hour and a half, if that, you know, 15 minutes. Dressed it, and then people were coming in, like yourself, Michelle came in, and there was some, you know, you had quite a lot of input, and then, you know, Chris came in and had, you know, 15 seconds input, and then went away again. And so there was that, was building up, you know, redressing it, and the fire and whatnot. And then, so that happened, and I gradually built it up, and there were lots and lots of layers to Carl's house. And then I kind of left it, and I had a lot of time on my own to dress it. And then I had final half a day, finished dressing it, left it. And then I came back, and there was just Neil, and he'd lit it. And I almost burst out crying. It just looked amazing. And I lit the candles inside to see how it would look.
I have seen this.
And it just looked amazing.
It did look amazing.
Because lit properly from above with the huge, you know, I think it's a 2.5K flood or HMI or something. Yeah. It's massive HMI floodlight coming through the roof. Moonlight. sunlight, actually, isn't it? It's flooding in. And with the candles lit inside, it's just quite special, actually. So I felt really quite privileged to have been able to do that. Because it's such a beautiful little building. So thank you, Michael and Chris, for...
And Tindy had a huge amount, and Andrew Bailey had a huge amount to do with that. And lots of people contributed to that set.
So all I did was just dress it. And you know, Neil did just a beautiful job lighting it. And Squish. Because there was a little aperture on the side on the floor. There was a sort of hole, and I said, how's that going to work? He's got a hole there, and Squish put this beautiful light coming through from the bottom that really worked. And
was that the fire light?
No, the other side. The other side.
Ah, okay.
That bounced in through from the floor upwards onto Ren and Khan. So that's probably a real highlight for me, because that was such a lovely space for people. It was like a retreat.
I always, if I was having a hard day, I would go and visit one of the sets or costume.
Costume was also a really nice environment.
I would instantly feel better.
Yeah,
because I would just look around at these beautiful things and think, you know, this is okay, it's going to be good, you know.
Exactly. The costume department was just lovely. Yeah, again, there's lots of... there's too many nice moments, actually. Really, there's too many nice moments. When Chris came back, thank God.
Yeah, speaking of the devil, yeah. But this is surely longer than half an hour.
Yeah, I have got to go and cook some vegetables.
So you mentioned Tindy and you mentioned Andrew. We'd be here all night if we tried to get all those names out. We can't do that. But I think one thing that strikes me for Ren was the sheer number of volunteers that came along. And people from America, from Holland, from Germany, what's your thoughts about that? And perhaps, you know, something you might like to say to them on the podcast.
Thank you.
What I would say to viewers is, when you're watching a fantasy adventure, you know, a costume dependent drama, just check out all those credits and then realize that, you know, the budget for this was £30,000 and no one was paid, and we had to get all that work done that everyone else hires hundreds and hundreds of people to do through entirely volunteer labor, and we did it. And that was because so many people were willing to come back over and over again and give us, and I'm so aware of this, they were giving us their time, their valuable time, their lives, part of their lives, over and over again. And, you know, we would call at the last minute. We were often not organized enough or not there at the times that we said we were going to be there, and everything was a movable feast. And, you know, I can't thank them enough. You know, I just cannot express how amazed I am at how generous people were. You know, I'm just absolutely amazed. And luckily, I have heard from most of them, and they've said, we loved it, we got a lot out of it. So I feel relieved that it was, you know, they feel it was worth their while. But yes, thank you so much. And to people who contributed in other ways, you know, by sharing things on Facebook or just kind of encouraging us when we were very worried, and still are, that we didn't communicate enough. And again, tiny, tiny team, guys. But we didn't communicate enough with people. Sometimes Kate would say something about that, and we'd get supporters from all around the world saying, don't worry about it, you're doing a great job. And it's like, thank you so much for saying that. So it was just so appreciated, you know, it just really was appreciated. And I hope that they will be delighted by the result and will feel pleased that they contributed.
Yeah, that's a great sentiment. And you mentioned earlier on the word collaboration. I think that sums it up very well. So I think I'll end it there. Thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.